Is that something that you've come across frequently in your research that this type of thing happens?
Well, anytime that there's a very unusual situation, something that will cause stress to the monkey, such as in that situation, the construction noise, that does make the animals become more aggressive. They're already stressed out just by being in a laboratory setting. And then when there's any outside negative kind of stressor, that just makes the whole situation worse. And so, of course, they act out. They become more aggressive with each other. And as you mentioned in the situation that you're discussing, the consequences are often fatal. And in fact, the incident that you're referencing is something that we had uncovered when we obtained correspondence between OHSU and the National Institutes of Health, because typically laboratories discuss noncompliance issues like that, and that was one of the documents that was part of an official complaint we had filed against OHSU earlier this year, and that's what led to them being cited by the USDA.
And what would you suggest for Oregonians who are concerned about the mistreatment of primates in the OHSU facility? What should people do to find out more or get involved?
Well, the one thing I would suggest is that everyone can certainly find us, Stop Animal Exploitation Now, through our Facebook page or through our website, and we will be happy to put them in contact with local activist groups that we're currently working with to assemble opposition to the laboratory as far as grassroots activism in the form of protests and other events.
And again, that website is Stop Animal Exploitation Now, SAEN online.org. I've been speaking with Michael Budke. He is with Stop Animal Exploitation Now, that have just put out a report documenting the worst primate labs in the United States. The local lab at Oregon Health Science University, OHSU, was found to be number two on that list of the worst primate labs in the country. Thank you for joining us today, Michael
Thank
Budke.
you for having me on the program.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Lisa Loving, Delphine Crescenzo, and Don Merrill will host 3 hours of talk about the elections from the KBOO perspective and include special guests, KBOO reporters in the field, and members of Oregon community media phoning in from all over the state. We'll talk candidates, measures, winners, losers, voter disenfranchisement, and more. Again, that's Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, taking place Thursday, October 30th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland. Participants will learn about the debt system, listen to personal stories on how debt affects our daily lives, connect with groups working to redefine our funding priorities, and organize. Again, that's the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, Thursday, October 30th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess, this is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
This KBOO program.
When you're not visible, who right are you talking about? So you first become visible, then the law takes notice of it and changes. That's an organic way of going about it. Morally and politically, you cannot have unequals in a free country.
You are the ally that sends me links to articles you only read the title to. You are the ally. You are the ally that will think, gosh, this couldn't possibly be a poem about me.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Roman Catholic bishops pull a proposed pastoral LGBT welcome mat, India's activists engage in culture wars, and critics offer worthwhile words on identity and allyship. All that and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Natalie Peebles.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 18th, 2014. The Roman Catholic Church made headlines early this week with the release of a draft document that spoke of welcoming homosexual persons and providing them a fraternal space. While maintaining the Church's stance opposing marriage equality, the document also stated that people in same-gender relationships provide precious support for each other. However, the text was widely condemned by leading English-speaking conservative Catholics as a departure from the Church's teachings. A new watered-down English-language version of the document issued later in the week instead speaks of providing for, not welcoming, homosexual persons and offers fellowship instead of fraternal space. The revised version also replaces the precious support same-gender couples give each other with valuable support. Vatican spokesperson Federico Lombardi told reporters that the updated language had been provided by the group of bishops who are working on the document in English, but that the Italian version is always the definitive text, and it has not been changed. The Spanish and French language versions have reportedly also not been changed. The bishops are meeting in Rome as part of an extraordinary gathering of church leaders called by Pope Francis I to consider the Roman Catholic Church's official approach to a variety of social issues relating to sexuality, reproduction, and the family.
As expected, Kyrgyzstan's parliament overwhelmingly passed a bill on its first reading this week that outlaws the distribution of information by groups or individuals, including journalists, aimed at forming positive attitudes toward non-traditional sexual relations. One of the bill's lead sponsors told Reuters that it was all about protecting the traditional family and that upon its enactment, there will be no possibility to arrange gay clubs, gay cafes, or to hold gay rallies. Whereas a similar law passed last year in Russia punishes offenders with heavy fines, convictions under this law in Kyrgyzstan, a former Soviet satellite country, not only bring back-breaking fines, but also up to a year in prison. The bill passed by a 79-7 vote on October 15th. It needs to be approved in two more readings and then signed by President Almazbek Atambayev, a staunch ally of Russia, to become law. Kyrgyz lawmakers are also pushing for a law similar to Russia's that would require non-governmental organizations that receive foreign funding to register as foreign agents, an old Soviet colloquialism for spies. One of its supporters told EurasiaNet.org that the bill would protect the country from foreign sabotage and sexual emancipation. Same-gender sex in the conservative, mostly Muslim Central Asian nation was only decriminalized 16 years ago.
Meanwhile, the Pacific Island Republic of Palau has decriminalized gay sex in a revision of its penal code. Although the new criminal laws took effect at the end of July, they were only announced this week. The new code was passed by the Palau National Congress and signed into law by President Tommy Remengeso in April. Palau lies in the western Pacific Ocean east of the Philippines and is home to about 21,000 people across 250 islands. Private consensual adult gay sex was previously punishable there by up to 10 years in prison, although lesbian sex was never outlawed. Eight other nations in the region still outlaw gay sex.
In related news, lawmakers in New South Wales are joining their peers in two other Australian states to expunge criminal convictions for consensual adult gay male sex before it was legalized in the state in 1984. The New South Wales Legislative Assembly, or lower house, approved the private members' bill authored by Liberal Party MP Bruce Notley-Smith, the first openly gay man to be elected to that chamber. He believes it will also pass handily with bipartisan support in the upper house. Independent MP Alex Greenwich, the second openly gay man to be elected to the Legislative Assembly, applauded the bill's passage. "What better way to mark the 30th anniversary of decriminalization," he said, "than passing legislation that says the gay community should have never been criminalized in the first place. Victoria and South Australia have already passed similar legislation."
A memorial plaque was scheduled to be unveiled on October 18th in Paris by Mayor Anne Hidalgo to remember the last men executed in France for homosexuality. Bruno Lenoir, a cobbler in his 20s, and 40-year-old servant Jean Dio were publicly burned alive at the stake on July 6, 1750, under the country's anti-gay law. Parisian city councillor Ian Brossat told the French LGBT news site YAG that they were executed for nothing but the crime of being gay.
In happier news, the Scottish government has set the date for marriage equality, New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2014. The Marriage and Civil Partnership Scotland Act will come into force on December 16th, but there's a 15-day waiting period. Any same-gender couple in a civil partnership can also convert it to marriage, and married transgender people will not be forced to divorce or dissolve their civil partnership before applying for a change in gender recognition. The new law also says that trans people's spouses cannot block them from having their true gender recognized, as was previously the case. When 2015 dawns, same-gender couples in the entire United Kingdom will be able to tie the knot, except for Northern Ireland, where marriage equality is not even on the agenda.
Updating the growth of marriage equality in an increasing number of U.S. states, as best we can in an incredibly fluid situation, gay and lesbian couples began tying the knot this week in Arizona after a federal judge officially declared that state's ban on civil marriage for same-gender couples to be unconstitutional. And in Idaho, after Republican Governor Butch Otter decided not to appeal the Ninth Circuit ruling that confirmed the ban in his state to be unconstitutional.
Several lesbian and gay couples were expected to begin marrying by week's end in Alaska, following a federal judge's ruling on October 13th overturning that state's ban and his refusal to issue a stay. Officials in the remote northern town of Barrow already waived the usual 3-day waiting period and allowed two lesbian couples to be the first to wed in the state.
A federal judge in Wyoming also ruled this week that the state cannot deny marriage licenses to same-gender couples. He put his ruling on hold until October 23rd to allow state officials time to appeal if they so desire, or forever hold their peace. But marriages in Wyoming could start earlier than that. Republican Governor Matt Mead, who's up for re-election, said during a candidates' debate earlier in the week that the state shouldn't appeal what was then an anticipated ruling. And on October 17th, his office confirmed that the Wyoming Attorney General will file notice with the court that the state will not appeal.
Lawsuits are underway challenging the bans in South Carolina, Montana, Kansas, and Puerto Rico. A ruling by the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is imminent and affects civil marriage bans in Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. The 5th Circuit will consider marriage bans in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, while an 11th Circuit ruling will affect bans in Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. And finally, the 8th Circuit will consider bans in Arkansas, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. It's generally agreed that the Supreme Court will only step in if one or more of those circuits upholds state marriage bans. If none does, marriage equality will have become the law of the land without further high court intervention. Meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it will now recognize the marriages of gay and lesbian couples in Colorado, Indiana, Nevada, Oklahoma, Utah, Virginia, and Wisconsin, giving them access to all the federal benefits available to legally married couples.
Equality activists in Taiwan have kept up the pressure on government officials to open civil marriage to same-gender couples there. Depending on which media report you want to believe, a demonstration in support of marriage equality outside the Taiwanese parliament building in Taipei earlier this month drew anywhere from 2,000 to 20,000 people. A bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples has been stalled in parliament for more than a year. Even though about 200 Christian fundamentalists protested a public hearing on the issue this week, legislator Yu Mei-nu has vowed to put a marriage equality bill on the agenda of this parliamentary session. In addition to religious fundamentalists, opposition has also come from conservative politicians who insist that the Taiwanese people are not ready for marriage equality. One lawmaker also argued that changing man and woman, husband and wife, and father and mother to gender-neutral terms in the island's marriage laws would involve too many regulations.
And finally, while marriage equality in Taiwan appears to be moving at the proverbial snail's pace, scientists there have paid tribute to the effort and diverse families with their name for a newly discovered species of land snail that's native to the island. The snail is widespread throughout eastern Taiwan, but was previously mistaken for a closely related species and is in fact more like a land snail from Ishigaki Island in Japan. Lead researcher Dr. Yen Cheng Li reported in the scientific journal Zookies that the Taiwanese snails are hermaphrodite animals, which means they have both male and female reproductive organs in a single individual. They represent the diversity of sexual orientation in the animal kingdom, he continued. We decided that maybe this is a good occasion to name the snail to remember the struggle for the recognition of same-sex marriage rights. The new Taiwanese land snail species has been named Aegista diversifamilia.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 18th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Natalie Peoples.
In late-breaking news from the Vatican, Roman Catholic bishops have rejected both the progressive LGBT-welcoming draft of their document on ministering to families and its watered-down, not-so-welcoming revision. Some observers believe that the 118-62 defeat of the compromise version was in part a protest vote by LGBT-supportive bishops. As they returned home, the bishops were charged to reflect on the issue before they meet again next year.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
Speaking out on sexual and gender politics from Mumbai to Brooklyn, later in the program.
Life's not worth a damn till you can say, hey world, I am what I am.
Who you are is the topic of two nonfiction picks from our literary commentator, Janet Mason.
Reading two new books on LGBTQ identity gave me pause to reflect on the fact that identity is an ongoing issue for us all. Perhaps this is particularly true as the mainstream wants to assimilate us. A positive view of LGBTQ, embracing identity and cultural well-being by Ellen D.B. Riegel and Sharon S. Rostowski. Roman and Littlefield, 2012, talks about the unique strengths that being LGBTQ can engender, including looking at relationships differently, having compassion for other oppressed groups based on their own outsider status, and using the introspection that comes from the necessary self-understanding about your sexual orientation or gender identification to be true to yourself in all ways. A 57-year-old trans woman from Arizona says, "The transition in crossing genders was a spiritual adventure to me. Facing all the fears that are there, such as losing one's job, losing friends, losing finances, and one's home, was very fearful. Facing these fears and realizing I was willing to lose all these things to be myself was a sacred and spiritual experience. To walk through the possibilities of losing everything gave me an understanding of what the Buddhists call attachments to desire. And when I lost these attachments, it felt as though I had entered a new world where everything is possible and magic is all around." Living Out Ism, Voices of Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender Muslims by Scott Siraj Alha-Kugel, New York University Press, 2014, examines the lives of Muslim LGBTQ people who live in democratic countries such as the United Kingdom, Canada, the Netherlands, and the United States, where it is safe to be out and to be activists. The book emphasizes that a key tenet of the Muslim religion is to protect the vulnerable and help the downtrodden. The book is based on interviews designed to capture something of the unique personality of the activists interviewed while highlighting themes many have in common. All those interviewed have a very strong relationship to their faith. One lesbian recounts her struggle with getting her family to see the situation as she did. "I didn't see any contradiction between my being Muslim and my being a lesbian. Islam is a loving faith. It is accepting of diversity and is about justice. My faith has always kept me going." While living out Islam will be of most interest to Muslim people who are LGBTQ, it also serves as a helpful resource for their families and friends, as well as for those in the non-Muslim LGBTQ community who want to better understand and empathize. Reading these two books back-to-back reminded me that identity is almost always multi-layered, and at the same time fragile. It's important to remember who we are. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and leisure for This Way Out.
When allies fail, poetry prevails. Here on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. But first, we last heard from Sapphic Nomads Katie Cook and Maggie Young on their visit to India. The intrepid documentarians stayed a while longer in Mumbai to spend some time with a psychologist and couples therapist.
In this third installment from our four-part series from India, we talked to Deepak Kashyap, a psychologist and couples therapist living and working in Mumbai, India. Curious about gender dynamics within India, we asked Deepak about his thoughts on gender politics between men and women within the queer movement.
The gender politics at the polity level, I think we, on papers, we are required to see them as equals. Now, laws don't change cultures. Cultures can change laws. But if you force a law on an existing culture, it will take a long time before it changes. For example, first we changed the culture. We had been fighting for the whole gay rights thing from, I think the first time we applied to the government was sometimes in the 90s. But then we started changing the culture bit by year by year by year. And first we held a gay pride parade. We became visible. Here we are fighting for our rights. When you're not visible, whose right are you talking about? Right? So you first become visible, then the law takes notice of it and changes. That's an organic way of going about it. So on papers, we are required to be same towards women and men, and you know the whole idea of gay rights. The gay word has to include women, but because not a lot of gay men make room for women, you require a different terminology, thereby is subsuming gay as a label in a larger queer concept. The concept of being queer. So the politics around it is such that, now you look at it this way, two vulnerable groups already, okay? They interact with each other and they suddenly don't find too much in common, surprisingly. But morally and politically, you cannot have unequals in a free country. Now, this is an ideal which comes from the Age of Enlightenment in England. When people say, oh, this is all gay rights and everything is Western concept, I kind of agree that this whole thing is Western import, because the idea of giving equal rights to people, not homosexuality is not a Western import, of course, it's a human condition. The whole gay rights thing is a Western import because we don't have a culture of giving equal rights to people. You are an untouchable. Oh, I am. You are the Shudras, and I am the Rajput, and I am the Brahmin, and I'm the Pan. So we've always had an acceptance for inequality. So this whole egalitarian idea of enlightenment age is coming to India. And no equal rights. Why are you doing? What is equal? So India's definition of equal is some people are more equal than others. And then women get like the second layer. Women are not as equal as men. So this entire idea of equality is a Western import, and I would rather I import this. I'd rather that we use this as a foil. Because it also, see, India is the only country in the world where you'll see social power, economic power, and political power being at three different junctures. You could be economically powerful, but nothing socially if you are not of a good caste. A Brahmin, a poor Brahmin can look at you and say, you're not a Brahmin. So it's the only country where social importance, economic importance, and political power can be at three different areas.
We then asked Deepak about his work as a couples therapist.
The same problem is anywhere. A relationship is a relationship is a relationship. It just comes with different genitals. Trust me. It's the same 7 to 8 problems that go on in a couple's life. Demand for reciprocity, fairness. You're not being fair to me. I'm not visible. You don't listen to me. Do I matter to you? Am I of any significance in your future? Where is my place? It's the same thing that we've been craving from childhood. Mom, do you love me? Do you look at me? It's a beautiful but a very seductive trap that we make our partners, our parents. This whole smuggling in of love patterns in the way we love our parents, in the way we love our lovers. What psychological need do you think the baby talk fulfills? Security. I can trust you. I can be my vulnerable childish self in front of you and hope that you'd protect me and love me. And you won't judge me for the worst in me, but you would push yourself to understand the worst in me. Straight and gay couple, it is so beautiful to see that we share the same trials and tribulations and triumphs of humanity.
This concludes the third part of our 4-part series from India. To learn more about our Sapphic Nomads project, please visit our website at www.nomaddocumentary.com, or you can visit our Sapphic Nomads Facebook page. Till next time, this is Maggie Young with fellow Sapphic Nomad Katie Cook, reflecting on our time in Mumbai, India, for This Way Out.
And finally this week, Brooklyn, New York-based black, trans, queer, rowdy-as-hell poet J. Mays III has a few words for shaky supporters.
You are the kind of ally that spends more time asking me how to twerk than how to pronounce my name. You are the kind of ally that doesn't know what cisgender means but loves staring at my chest before you address me. You are the kind of ally that makes me wonder who my enemies are and trips over words like transphobia and white supremacy. You are the kind of ally that will practice your sassy black woman voice in the mirror, but cross the street when black folks pass by you on street corners. You are the kind of ally that just showed up to help gay people at fancy weddings. You are the kind of ally that wants to take pictures together just for advertising purposes. You are the ally that calls my family's neighborhood up and coming but would never want to bring up the word gentrification. You are ally on white horse, seemingly scooping down to rescue me from my own depravities. You are the kind of ally that shops only at Whole Foods. You are the ally that doesn't realize being gay won't save you from your white privilege. You are the ally that tells old black men how adorable they are. You are the ally that sends me links to articles you only read the title to. You are the ally. You are the ally that will think, gosh, this couldn't possibly be a poem about me. You are ally waving righteous sword that loves to hear me tell a sad story over and over again because vicariously living my pain gives you street cred. You are the kind of ally that thinks intersectionality uses too many syllables. You are the ally that thinks it's okay to describe someone as having the nerve to be both big and black. You are the ally that loves the texture of my hair. You are the ally that thinks fucking me is the same thing as fighting for me. You are the kind of ally that thinks you are hilarious when you rap. You are the ally that writes depressing poems in my honor but never fully gets my complexities. You are the ally that has enough time to Google celebrity sex tapes but not rules on allyship. You are the ally that celebrates Don't Ask, Don't Tell because kids that look like you will never be forced to cross seas to bomb kids that look like them just so they can have fictitious freedom. You are the ally that thinks being accepted is the same thing as being understood. Yeah. You are the ally that laughs way too hard at my jokes. You are the kind of ally that will share a poem like this on YouTube but will never listen to the words. You are the kind of ally that likes to use the word minorities. You are the kind of ally that believes being on food stamps for your adult AmeriCorps position is the same as a 10-year-old brain eating itself for nourishment. You are the kind of ally that thinks I talk too loud when I'm angry. You are the ally that thinks rape is funny because it hasn't happened to you yet. You are the ally that thinks saying you are colorblind is a compliment. You are the ally that thinks believing in systemic oppression is an option. You are the ally that will fuck up my pronouns but think it's okay because we're friends. You are the kind of ally that will need to appropriate some yoga after this poem. You are the kind of ally that will only remember to that last line about yoga in this poem. You are the ally that never has to progress because you hide behind a title proclaiming yourself to be my ally.
That was J. Mays III performing #AllyFail at the Capturing the Fire 2014 Queer Spoken Word Summit and Slam in Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Natalie Peoples, Michael LeBeau, Janet Mason, and Sapphic Nomads, Maggie Young and Katie Cook contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. John Barrowman performed some of the music you heard, J. Mays III performed #AllyFail, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, and our generous listeners for supporting this program. You can find lots of information about the show, including mugshots of the crew, at thiswayout.org, including online listening and social media links. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CFXU, Antigonish, Nova Scotia, WRUW, Cleveland, Ohio, KMUN, Astoria, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
That's what these homosexuals are trying to do. These people are terrorists, they're radicals, and they're extremists.
That was our mission. Let's go to the city, hang out, go to the pier. You know, it's nothing but gay people. We're going to go out there and flirt and have fun and laugh and just chill. He spit in my face and threw a cigarette, and he swung at me.
And by the time I turned around, he had Renato on the ground choking her.
There were a pack of lesbians who jumped this guy and almost killed him.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Liberian churchmen blame gay people for Ebola. U.S. televangelist Pat Robertson issues a gay terrorism alert. And black New Jersey lesbians go to prison just for going out in the night. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 25th, 2014. Right-wing religious crackpots around the world routinely blame LGBT people for everything from floods to tornadoes to drought. Few take them seriously. But leaders of Liberia's Roman Catholic and Anglican churches are claiming that the Ebola outbreak there, one of the worst on the African continent, is God's punishment for the country's acceptance of homosexuality, and they are being taken seriously there. The Liberian Council of Churches said in a statement earlier this year that God was angry with the people of Liberia because it was a nation of immoral acts. Louis Zeigler, the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Church of Liberia, specifically targeted gay people. "Where are we going as Liberians if we are advocating for homosexuality?" he asked. "Are we not calling for curses upon ourselves?" A widely cited Reuters report this week said that LGBT people across the West African country are doubly threatened by the Ebola outbreak. They fear not only contracting the virus, but escalating anti-LGBT assaults, including calls for their execution. Monrovia-based activist Leroy Ponpon told the news agency that homophobic violence has become so pervasive that many in the LGBT community are reluctant to leave their homes, and some who do wear disguises. "Right now," he said, "all we want is protection." With a population of about 4 million people, Liberia has been among the most affected countries in the recent outbreak of the virus, with more than 4,500 cases of the disease and 2,700 deaths.
A Nigerian federal high court judge this week dismissed a challenge to the country's draconian anti-gay laws because the man who filed the suit is heterosexual and therefore not directly affected by them. Joseph Taria Eba sued the government for enacting what's come to be known as the Jail All the Gays Law last year, which his suit called a violation of the fundamental human rights of LGBT Nigerians guaranteed in the nation's constitution. The 42-year-old Nigerian native is married with children and has lived in the UK for the last 14 years. But he told BuzzFeed that, "I decided I wasn't going to accept a Nigeria that was discriminatory." Private consensual adult gay sex was already illegal in the country, but the new law increased penalties for those acts, criminalized advocacy for LGBT rights, banned same-gender couples from civil marriage, punishes same-gender couples who try with 14 years in prison, and wedding guests with 10 years. Activists worry that any self-identified LGBT person who files a challenge to the law could be immediately arrested. Abba's brother and lawyer, Mike and Ahoro Abba, said they would appeal the ruling.
About 20 hooded vandals invaded the second anniversary party of an LGBT center in the Macedonian capital of Skopje this week, throwing bottles and crates and leaving one young woman injured.
Balkan Insight said the attack took place at the Damar Cafe in the city's Old Bazaar area, and that the 10-minute assault became a stampede. Witnesses says they didn't see the faces of the assailants because they wore hoods, but one described them as well-organized. They had an exact plan of how to enter, she said, what to demolish, and when to leave before the police came. Vandals attacked the center twice in 2013, once when people were inside watching a movie, and later in the year when no one was in the building. The police failed to make arrests in either case. The center is financially supported by the Dutch embassy. Outgoing Dutch ambassador, Mariette Sherman, said the failure of authorities to curb anti-LGBT violence creates a perception that this is sponsored, or tolerated in the best case, by the government and used as an instrument to make people afraid and to try to shut them up. Aranya Porovska, director of the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights in Macedonia, a host of the event, said that in Macedonia, the fundamental rights of the LGBT community have no value. Their right to live is endangered.
But a civilian transgender U.S. military employee has won a landmark discrimination case. Army veteran Tamara Lusardi, who's disabled, endured ongoing discrimination while working at the Army's Aviation and Missile Research Development and Engineering Center in Alabama. Her suit claimed that her superiors banned her from using female bathrooms and continued to refer to her as he and sir. She finally filed a complaint with the Office of Special Counsel, an independent federal investigative and prosecutorial agency, which ruled this week that the abuse she suffered was sufficiently frequent, pervasive, and humiliating to constitute discriminatory harassment. As a disabled veteran, Lusardi said in a statement, I take great pride in my role protecting our soldiers from harm. Like anyone else, I just want the freedom to be myself at work. The case is the latest example of the Obama administration's increasing defense of the rights of transgender people under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlaws bias based on gender.
Transgender people are, however, currently banned from active military service in the United States. Trans military personnel from 18 other countries gathered last week in Washington, D.C. to discuss how the U.S. military might join them. The conference, entitled Perspectives on Transgender Military Service from Around the Globe, was billed as a first-ever international gathering of trans military service members. Featured speakers included transgender officers from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, a former U.S. Navy SEAL who transitioned after her service, an intelligence officer with the Swedish Air Force, and a squadron leader for the British Royal Air Force. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel signaled a willingness to consider transgender service earlier this year, but later backtracked and said he was not inclined to formally review the current policy.
Breaking with most of his peers, a federal judge has upheld the ban on civil marriage for same-gender couples in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. District Judge Perez Jimenez wrote that the very survival of the political order depends upon the procreative potential embodied in traditional marriage. The question now, he concluded, is whether judicial wisdom may contrive methods by which those solid principles can be circumvented or even discarded. An appeal of the ruling to the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is in the works. Marriage equality already flourishes in all the U.S. states over which that court has jurisdiction.
Lesbian and gay couples still can't get married in Kansas, Montana, and South Carolina, even though the U.S. Supreme Court recently let stand federal court rulings with jurisdiction over those states that overturned their civil marriage bans. Officials in each state are demanding that a federal court specifically order them to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples.
And even though gay and lesbian couples have already started tying the knot in Alaska following a district court ruling striking down the ban there, the state's Republican governor and attorney general are asking for what's called an en banc review by 11 judges of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. A three-judge panel of the court has already upheld district court rulings that struck down bans in other states.
Idaho's Republican governor, Butch Otter, who last week said he wouldn't challenge the overturning of the ban in his state, reversed course this week and is now asking for an en banc review by the 9th Circuit of its three-judge panel's ruling that struck down the bans in his state and in Nevada. But Nevada's Republican governor, Brian Sandoval, says he's opposed to such a challenge. Absent his administration's defense of the ban, the right-wing Coalition for the Protection of Marriage is asking the entire 9th Circuit to review the ruling. A major issue in that case will be the conservative organization's legal standing to intervene. Same-gender couples have already started marrying in both Idaho and Nevada.
Meanwhile, Utah's Supreme Court lifted a ban on adoptions by same-gender couples this week following a request by Republican Attorney General Sean Reyes. His office requested a stay earlier this year after a district judge asked officials to explain why such couples were not being allowed to adopt children. The state now opening adoptions to married same-gender couples appears to be a byproduct of the Supreme Court's recent refusal to hear a case overturning Utah's civil marriage ban.
Elsewhere, organizers of the 6th annual Hong Kong Pride celebration have chosen an umbrella as this year's symbol, in coincidental solidarity with the city's pro-democracy movement. 500 rainbow umbrellas were ordered in early August, more than a month before the street protests, known as Occupy Central, began. The Cantonese word for putting up an umbrella sounds like support, and protesters have been using them to defend against tear gas, pepper spray, and police batons. Pride spokeswoman Wei Siu Lik said that, "We support civil society and we hope it can support us in return too." More than 8,000 people marched with Pride in 2013. The South China Morning Post reports that participants are scheduled to begin this year's march at Hong Kong's Victoria Park on the afternoon of November 8th.
And finally, out actor and activist Sir Ian McKellen reprised his role as the wizardly Gandalf from the Lord of the Rings trilogy during a visit to Chew Valley School this week as part of the work to combat campus bullying and homophobia. Speaking to a crowd of students, he also urged them to study well.
In your preparation for your examinations, if you don't do your revision properly, do you know what will happen? You shall not pass!
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 25th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Out in the Night exemplifies injustice. Later in the program. You might remember this golden oldie.
In San Francisco, some of the gay community, they want to get people, so if they've got the stuff, they'll have a ring, you shake hands, and the ring's got a little thing where you cut your finger. I mean, it's that kind of vicious stuff, which would be the equivalent of murder.
Or maybe this is your recent favorite from U.S. televangelist Pat Robertson's homophobic hit parade.
What the gays are saying is, we're going to drive you out of town. Either you conform to us or you must leave. That's the message that's being put out. It's the same message that there was in Sodom and Gomorrah. You're either going to have open sex with anybody or else you leave.
Every time he opens his foot-filled mouth on the issue, one would think that Robertson has hit bottom, but he keeps bottoming himself. He'd already cautioned a missionary on his show this week to beware of getting AIDS from towels in Africa. Then Right-Wing Watch caught one of their most prolific offenders in another unfounded diatribe, this time about a group of pastors in Houston, Texas, who've been called to testify about their petition-gathering practices during a failed effort to repeal the city's anti-discrimination law. He even dragged Houston's out-mayor, Anise Parker, into the mix.
There's one thing to want to persuade somebody to believe like you do. That's what Christianity is about, to bring the gospel message, say this is good news and we'd like you to accept it. That's one thing. There's something else to take the arm of the government to force somebody to do something that is against, is contrary to their religion. And that's what these homosexuals are trying to do. They're trying to force people who are Christians to marry them or else face jail, to make cakes honoring them or else go to jail, and give their servants over and divulge their innermost thoughts or go to jail. Now, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. These people are terrorists, they're radicals, and they're extremists. No Christian, in his right mind, would ever try to enforce somebody against their belief or else suffer jail. Now, they did that during the Inquisition. It was horrible. It was a black mark on our history. But it isn't being done now. There's no Christian group I know of anywhere in the world that would force somebody to do something contrary to their deep-held religious beliefs or else face criminal penalties. But that's what the homosexuals are trying to do here in America, and I think it's time pastors stand up and fight this monstrous thing. I mean, if the gays want to go out and do their gay sex, that's one thing, but if they want to force you to accept it and solemnify it by marriage, then that's a different matter, and it's an infringement on people's religious beliefs. And what's being done in Houston is a gay, the woman they elected is a homosexual. She's a lesbian. And that's her, she's trying to force pastors to conform to her beliefs. It's wrong.
That was right-wing, fact-free televangelist Pat Robertson. What will he think of next?
I'm Diddly Day, an actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity, an actor's life for me.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what This Way Out does as well, right here on this station.
Their real-life American Horror Story was sensationalized by the media and criminalized by overzealous law enforcement. Now it's been documented in a new film by Blair Dorsch Walther. That prompted entertainment correspondent Steve Pride to get the story directly from two of the women whose lives were forever changed after they simply went out in the night.
What's the difference between a gathering of white heterosexual women and black lesbians? To the New York City police, it's pretty obvious that one is a group of friends. Perhaps they're even named Carrie, Samantha, Charlotte, and Miranda. And the others, the butch black ones, well, they're a gang. An aggressive and dangerous man-hating gang. Or as the press would later label them, a wolf pack and a seething sapphic septet. That's why a Greenwich Village altercation in 2006 between a violent man and a group of seven young friends became a sensationalized national story, and why the women, who had never been a member of any gang, faced enhanced gang-related charges during their year-long trial.
Police operator 1512. Yeah, we had an ambulance over here on 6th Avenue and 3rd Street. The man stabbed on the ground bleeding.
Anonymous, unverified. Officers fighting with gangs, Bloods and Crips on street level.
Police operator 1398, where is the emergency?
There's a gentleman that was stabbed on by some girls.
Call, are you the patient?
No, man's on the floor, he's been stabbed.
Is the patient breathing?
Yes.
Awake. Is he awake? Hello?
Hi, I'm Renata Hill.
Hi, I'm Patrice Johnson.
In our neighborhood, at that time, it wasn't really LGBT friendly. And we hanging out and we sitting on the stoop. We wasn't ready to go in a house. So we like, you know what? Let's go to the city. None of us really had any money. We counting up change. As long as we had enough to get to the village, we like, let's just go out there, see the lights. You don't really need money to go to the city. You just need money to get there, and that's it, and get back home. You know, you go out, you look at all the stores, and just our company with each other, we would have a ball. We don't need no extra people, no music. That's just how we are. We laugh all night long. That was our mission. Let's go to the city, hang out, go to the pier. You know, it's nothing but gay people. We're going to go out there and flirt and have fun and laugh and just chill. And we wasn't even in the city for a good 10 minutes, I don't think. We got like a couple of blocks from when we got off the train and was approached by this guy in just a real disrespectful way. We really didn't take it too serious at first. Like, okay, you know, nah, we're all gay. These are all my girlfriends. You know, and he's like, oh, you a bum, this, that, and the third. You think you're a man. It just kind of escalated. And we're still laughing it off like, whatever. You know, he's just mad because he can't pick up no girls.
when he said, let me get some of that, I didn't automatically think he was being disrespectful. I really just thought he was asking for one of my co-defendants' soda. So I'm like, you know, give him your soda, get another one. She's like, I'm not giving him my soda. And I'm like, just give it to him. He's like, well, I don't want that. And he pointed down at my crotch, like, I want that. So I'm like, oh, no, you know, I'm a lesbian. I'm good, sir. And he was like, you a lesbian? So Renata was like, yes, these are all my girlfriends. And we all laughing, thinking he's joking. Like, nobody's thinking that he's serious. He got to be joking. So we tried to walk away like three times. The first time, we almost got hit by a garbage truck. Everybody jumped back up on the sidewalk. He's still talking to us. We tried to cross again and almost got hit by a whole bunch of cars. And like the third time, I just see a cigarette go over my shoulder and hit Renata. And then we turn around and he spits.
He decided he wanted to take it a step further because we wasn't really responding the way he wanted us to. I guess initially we were supposed to start like being aggressive and we wasn't. So he spit in my face and threw a cigarette and he swung at me.
I'm just standing there. And by the time I turned around, he had Renata on the ground choking her. And one of my co-defendants, she tried to pull Renata from up under him, and he reached up and he punched down her face. And the whole time, me and Terrain is just standing there like, oh my God, like, this is really happening. Like, why is this happening? And everybody is trying to get him off of Renata, yet he's pulling Shanice here at the same time, still choking Renata. And I'm like, this guy is crazy. And then I turn around and he's choking Venice. And once he starts choking Venice, she stops fighting him. Her face is starting to change colors and she's trying to get him off her neck. So I went to go grab my knife and I tried to cut his wrist to get him off her neck. And Renata is also trying to grab him to get her off him. He jumped on top of Renata and he continued to choke Renata. At that time, I backed up. And my other co-defendants came in and he's constantly trying to get him off of her, yet he's punching everybody or pulling their hair. And the fight just escalated. He pulled out one of my co-defendants' dress. He also pulled out Venice's hairpiece and swung it in the air and threw it at her. That night was just crazy.
He was out for blood, basically. And I don't understand, where we was females, you didn't really have to come at us like that. You didn't have to continue to come at us like that. We was just trying to defend each other. We wanted all of us to be away from him safely so that we can just keep going. Even at that time, our mind is still like, we would just want to go to the pier. We wasn't trying to, like, all right, this happened, we want to go home. No, we want to go to the pier. Let's go see some girls. Let's go hang out. We walked away from the incident. We went to McDonald's, which is literally across the street. We ordered something to eat. We're not trying to run. We go to use the bathroom. We come out, and it's cops everywhere going up, coming down. And we like, why is this happening? It wasn't that serious. We had a fight. We didn't think that he was really hurt because he was fighting somebody else when we walked away from the situation. Then we was like, you know what? Let's just go home. Let's get back to the train station. Let's go home. And they end up jumping out on us a block away from the train station. Our life was over at that point. Everything changed.
They were a pack of lesbians who jumped this guy and almost killed him.
He was attacked by a group of women yesterday in Manhattan. Police say the man made a comment, allegedly, to one of the women.
He was attacked because he was a straight man. Just a real nasty gang assault.
We didn't know how serious it was. Once they get us to the precinct, they held us there for over 24 hours, questioning us over and over again. Like, they just kept telling us if we did a statement, you guys could just get out of here. We just need you to write down what happened, write a statement. And at first, we're like, nobody says nothing. Don't say anything. But after hours and hours and hours of them coming in there, questioning us or leaving us in there alone for hours with no water, no food, and not knowing what's going on, it's like, okay, I'll write down what happened. Because at the end of the day, we wasn't really scared to write down what happened because we all was telling the truth about what happened, and nobody knew that this guy was injured. That was the main thing. Nobody knew that he was injured. I had no idea. So when they said to me, which one of you stabbed him? I laughed. Stabbed him. I'm like, yeah, right. I'm thinking about Law and Order, how they try to trick you to say something. And I'm like, yeah, right. Ain't nobody stabbed him. So now I'm thinking we playing around back and forth. And he's like, no. Somebody already admitted to stabbing him. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Clearly, I had no idea what he was talking about. So they was like, write down a statement. Just write down the truth and you could go home. And I did. My statement was, we came to New York. We ran into this guy. He approached us. We had an argument. We got into a fight. We got arrested. That's my statement. That's what happened. Then he got upset with that because he wanted to know exactly who played what role. But being honest with him, everything was happening so fast, I really don't know what was going on.
Next thing I know, we got all these indictments.
Assault in the first, assault in the second, assault in the third, gang assault in the first, gang assault in the second, attempted murder. I'm leaving out three, but I think it was a total of like 7 or 8 charges.
And I will assume the DA got on board and she the one that went forward with giving us all these charges.
We went to trial even though we was offered 6 months, 5 years probation. We figured that everything was in our favor, even the surveillance. We were backing away from him and he's coming towards us. He's taunting us. That's how it went down. So we felt like we had a fair fight because everything was out there. We went to trial, we fought it, and once we were found guilty, we was like, okay, we're going to get a little bit of time, not that much. When we got sentenced, it was just unbelievable. I was in shock. My sentence was 8 years.
Mine was 11. I was released from prison August 13th, 2013. It's really scary to know that you can't defend yourself. It's against the law to defend yourself. And that's basically what they were saying to us. We shouldn't have fought back. They actually tried to say we was heterophobic. We hate men. And that bothered me. How can you say we hate men? You didn't even ask us just because one guy. They made it seem like they had a history of us hating men. To say that statement, and that bothered me because I grew up with men. Like, that's all I have is brothers and male cousins. I only have one sister, and that was the only really female that was around, you know, other than the friends that I grew up with that was females. As far as my family is concerned, like, my dad is my best friend. How can you sit here and say I hate men? How can you sit here and say any of that?
We relive in that day over and over again. With every step forward we try to make, we have to explain what happened. Even if we're given that opportunity to explain, when you go look for a job and you have to check, yes, I have a felony, and the person that's reviewing the application, if there's somebody that don't know you and you have to write it out, because it's not so bad as checking, yes, I have a felony, but then writing down what the felony is and you have to write out gang assault. It's like, you're not going to go in Macy's and put, yeah, gang assault. And they're going to say, yeah, welcome. You're going to be the greeter at the front door. You know, it's automatically no bueno, no chances.
3 of the original 7 women accepted the plea deal. And of the 4 sentenced by the all-white jury, 2 later had their convictions overturned. This has been a conversation with Patrice Johnson and Renata Hill, who are not so lucky. A documentary about their ordeal called Out in the Night is making the rounds of film festivals across the USA. Find more information online at outinthenight.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening. Good.